20 different locks had been available before 1958. By 1961, only a dozen survived. Most were so similar that one key could open several padlocks. But prices for all products were higher, generally by about a third, in some cases double. The same could be said of foodstuffs. Since the launch of the Great Leap Forward, some 2,000 food peddlers had been forced to change jobs in Nanjing. Previously, individual hawkers had an intimate knowledge of complex market conditions and efficiently transported the vegetables to key delivery points in the city. But now a clumsy and rigid command economy only compounded the problems caused by famine in the countryside. The trade in surplus goods and waste material, thriving before 1949, also disintegrated. Lauding the widespread practice of recycling every conceivable object, Diabol observed before the fall of the empire that poverty encouraged care to be given to the most insignificant trifle, turning everybody into a merchant. But the exact opposite happened during the famine. Obsession with a master plan produced mountains of waste on the ground, since few people were given any incentives to recycle. In Guangzhou, some 170 tons of waste material, from iron oxide to graphite powder, was heaped about the city in the summer of 1959. Before the Great Leap Forward, every scrap of metal or shred of cloth would have been recycled by a small army of independent peddlers, who made sure that rags, cans, plastic, paper and tires reached a potential buyer. Many abandoned the trade after they'd been forced to enroll in a large and unresponsive collective. While the rubbish accumulated, shortages of the most basic necessities became endemic. In Nanjing, everything was scarce by the summer of 1959, even ordinary objects such as shoes and pots. Queues, the hallmark of socialism, were part of everyday life. As famine set in, they grew longer. In Jinan, some factory workers took 2 days off work to wait in line to buy grain. Li Shujun queued for 3 days but failed even to get a ticket, which had to be exchanged for a number, which in turn had to be exchanged for grain, all in different queues. In Shanghai, too, working men and women had to queue for the few goods which reached the shops. The ritual started before daybreak, as everybody knew that the shops would be empty by the afternoon. Patience could wear thin. Fights broke out when some people used bricks to mark their place in a queue, and these were then kicked over by others. In Wuhan, where up to 200 people had to wait in a single queue all night to buy rice towards the end of 1960, tempers flared and scuffles erupted. The state, rather than the market, determined the price of goods. This was supposed to stabilize prices and enhance the purchasing power of the people. But farmers bought manufactured goods at inflated prices, although they were forced to sell grain and other foodstuffs to the state at rock-bottom prices, often so low that they made a loss, as we have seen. A colossal transfer of wealth took place from the countryside to the cities. A sense of the scale of this was indicated by Lan Ling, an official with the inspectorate in Tsingtao. By compiling and adjusting the prices paid for food and goods since 1949, he found that the price for coal had increased by 18.5%, soap by 21.4%, shoes by up to 53%, rope by 55%, household goods by up to 157%, and ordinary tools by up to 225%. In contrast, the price paid by the state for grain had actually decreased, ranging from 4.5% for wheat to 10.5% for maize. Prices fixed by the state were rarely respected, if only because all sorts of additional charges could be made. A detailed inspection by the People's Congress in Guangzhou found that there could be up to 40 different transfer prices for the exact same type of metal bar. In the steel and iron industry, many of the prices actually charged were 50% higher than those mandated by the state. In some cases, the price rocketed by a factor of 10, contributing to a slump in industrial production as company managers had a hard time adjusting a rigid budget to the violent fluctuations in the supply costs. The price of coal, too, was fixed, but private deals struck between different enterprises led to relentless upward pressure. The actual cost of production thus soared, forcing the state to subsidize industries even further by trying to keep the prices of finished goods down. This too failed, as just about everything became more expensive, yet increasingly shoddy, from glass bottles and mothballs to hairpins and wooden clogs. In Wuhan, as everywhere else, the cost of a water bucket, an iron kettle, or a small fruit knife had doubled in a year or so since the launch of the Great Leap Forward. In the smelting capital of the new China, an iron pot cost 22 yuan, when 5 yuan would have sufficed in 1957. As Li Fuchun acknowledged in the summer of 1961, annual inflation was at least 10% for everything from food and commodities to services. But it reached 40 to 50% in some places. Some 12.5 billion yuan was squandered on goods worth only 7 billion. Other side effects of the planned economy appeared, because the profit motive rather than selfless dedication to the people's needs always lurked just under the surface of the paper plan. In the midst of humanity's greatest famine, a whole range of deluxe products were sold at a premium, from vegetables, cinema tickets, and tea leaves to simple pails. State-owned enterprises used widespread shortages to upgrade some of their goods and boost profits. When the People's Congress of Beijing decided to have a close look at the Beijing department store, the Stalinist flagship on Wang Fuqing, it found out how enterprises responded to inflationary pressure rather than to consumer demand. In 1958, around 10% of all underwear in the store was in the higher price bracket. The bulk, 60%, consisted of mid-range products accessible to most city dwellers. In 1961, more than half were luxury items, with a mere third carrying a mid-range price tag. This structural change came on top of inflation, which was estimated at 2.7% each month. As state-owned behemoths replaced small shops, the responsibility for defective goods shifted away from the street towards remote and impenetrable bureaucracies. The plan, of course, had an answer to this problem, setting up service stations, fuwuzu, for the benefit of the great masses. But they were few and far between, unable to cope with the deluge of shoddy goods and, most of all, utterly uninterested in serving the people. So in a poor country, the cost of fixing an object often exceeded the cost of replacing it. In Wuhan, the expense of having shoes resold, pots repaired or keys cut was double the state-mandated prices, as service stations effectively enjoyed a monopoly over repair work. In Xiangtan, Hunan, it cost 8 yuan to repair a fire pot, but only 9 yuan to buy a new one, while in many regions the cost of having socks darned was about the same as buying a new pair. Over the winter of 1960 to 61, as everybody was shivering from fuel shortages and inadequate clothing, repair centres in the capital were buried beneath heaps of defective goods. Apathetic employees merely pushed the stuff around, lacking the incentives, the tools, and the supplies to tackle their jobs. Even simple nails to resole a pair of shoes were unavailable. In the Tianmen commune in the heart of the capital, some 60 stoves lay about rotting. Broken furniture was strewn about the place, which was short of saws, planes and chisels. Even when service stations undertook to launder clothes, what should have been a relatively straightforward matter became caught in a hopeless quagmire. A cumbersome bureaucracy involved a whole series of separate steps, from registering the items and issuing a receipt to handing out the washed clothes all these operations being performed by different people involving a third of the workforce. Those who actually did the washing rarely managed more than 10 items a day. Everything was run at a loss and charged to the state, despite the high prices. On Shantou Road, Shanghai, a small laundry paid 140 yuan in salaries each month, although it only made about 100 yuan a month in income, not counting numerous lost items of clothing that had to be compensated for. Of course, most ordinary people would have preferred to repair their clothes, shoes and furniture themselves, but their tools have been taken away during the iron and steel campaign. Lao Tian remembered that in Suzhou, one of the country's model communes, for several years his mother had to queue up to borrow the only needle that had not been confiscated in the neighbourhood.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook, so please check your library for the next part of this audiobook. Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.